Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. The show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it's rebroadcast on Thursday or Friday nights, I believe, 7 p.m. on the same excellent channel, I should say station. You can also pick it up on Podomatic.com. Just go to the website, Podomatic.com, put in Camp Constitution Radio, and you can get this show probably within a week or so, as well as many of our archive shows and on our YouTube channel. So please visit us on YouTube as well and subscribe to our channel. And it is brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And our camp this year is going to be in the beautiful Berkshires of Massachusetts from August 5th to the 11th. And we've got an incredible lineup of instructors, including Lord Monckton, Dr. Duke Pesta, Mrs. Chris Ann Hall, and Professor Willie Soon. And we have a special guest on the line. Delegate Bob, as he's known, Bob Robert Marshall from Virginia. So welcome to the show, Bob.
Hal, thank you. Any Constitution show, I'm ready to go on. So,
well, before we talk about your book, How to Reclaim the Republic, I'd like to talk a little bit of background about your experiences in the legislature and your efforts to prevent an Article 5 convention. So first, give us a little background about you.
Well, I worked in Congress for 6 years for three members of Congress, one Democrat farm labor congressman who was pro-life, that was allowed to be pro-life at that time, and two Republicans, one Senator, Jeremiah Denton from Alabama, POW.
Oh, yes. He was one of the POWs, wasn't he, Vietnam?
Yes, he was. He was the one who blinked SOS torture with his eyes.
That's right.
When they were interviewed, and that's how we found out that the North Vietnamese were torturing our pilots. And then I also worked for Bob Dornan of Southern California.
He was known as what, B-1 Bomber
Bob?
B-1 Bob,
because the Rockwell International was in his district, and he was a big defender of the B-1 attack bomber. So, and then before that, as a private citizen, I had devised what became the original Hyde Amendment, cutting off Medicaid funds for abortion. I had a friend of mine did a Freedom of Information request to the appropriate federal agency and found out that 280,000 children had been killed with tax money in programs that are supposed to prevent so-called abortions, And I took this, went up to Congress with a former congressman I knew from Young Americans for Freedom when we were both, younger. Pulled him aside, showed him the FOIA, and I gave him words for an amendment to cut off funding. I said, I don't know if we're going to win or not. I can't count the noses here, but we need to get a record vote because the Democrats are killing all the bills that would curb abortion or restrict in some way in committee. Mm-hmm. So we have to get around that, and the only way to do that is an appropriations rider. So, and you didn't need permission of the Rules Committee to offer the amendments at that time. So this was a free chance to put everybody on the record. And we did, and interestingly, we won.
Was this known as the Hyde Amendment?
It became the Hyde Amendment, right. He said, this was Congressman Bauman of Southern Maryland, and he said, there's a freshman here who's very interested in the abortion question. I'm going to run your information by him. And about five or six weeks later, I looked in the paper. Lo and behold, there it was. Congressman Hyde putting the, putting the amendment. It's still law, so that has lasted some time.
So you were the one that initiated that?
Right.
Wow, phenomenal.
I just had the right connections. And let me tell you why this was so important. The reasoning I had was that Congress cannot afford to lose the power of the purse, even though they're profligate spenders. They still have to at least nominally control the purse to divvy up, the goodies. The proof of this occurred when I was with Congressman Dornan in a conference committee. A conference committee is a meeting between members of the House and Senate that are called to iron out the differences in a bill and report back identical legislation to each chamber. So Congressman Rangel was on the conference committee. Now, Rangel was a Catholic, but he's a liberal Catholic. He voted against the Hyde Amendment. He was in the Korean War. He's a bona fide war hero. but he just was a liberal Catholic. He came up to Bob Dornan, and he said, look, Bob, he's very friendly. And he said, you know that we differ on the abortion question, but I'll tell you this. This was right after the Supreme Court said Congress didn't have to fund abortion in McRae v. Harris. He said, if the Supreme Court had said that they're going to take our money, it actually is people's money, but I'll forgive them for that, that they're going to take our money and spend it for abortion, I would have put in court stripping bills faster than you would. Now, this is interesting because he opposed the Hyde Amendment, but he knew that Congress cannot lose the appropriations power without losing everything that they, you know, pretend to do.
Interesting.
So I knew that was the right tactic.
And then you eventually became a delegate, which is similar to, I guess in Virginia they call delegates, but most states
right.
are called representatives to the House.
Right. Punished for my past sins, the people elected me for my district to represent them.
And how many terms did you serve?
I served 13 terms. I'm not in the assembly anymore. 13. So it's 26
13.
Years.
13. Wow, that's phenomenal.
Right.
And you were one of the champions of opposing an Article 5 convention. Now, had you always been on that side of the issue?
I, you know, in the 1970s, when this was around, I looked at it and I thought, well, maybe it's not so bad. But I really didn't take a position one way or the other. I just hadn't studied a lot. But in the meantime, now, this is when I was working for Congressman Dornan. This is when people were trying to do anything to end abortion. But I did a significant amount of reading, including several hearings from the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate. Like, they're about 1,000 pages long. I went back and looked at the original documents and discovered that, wait a minute, this thing is a complete blank slate. And for Mark Levin or anybody else to say, if you call a convention, they're all going to meet like they did in the, you know, original Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 is completely fatuous. We didn't have a national structured government. We had the Articles of Confederation, which had no president, in which everybody did meet and they voted, you know, by the state delegations. Well, that's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And every analysis that I've seen coming out of the Library of Congress, when they try to analyze these calls, Article 5, indicate that Congress would make the rules. And again, if you actually read the Constitution itself, the states merely apply for the convention.
Apply, that's right.
That to apply for it is not to issue a call. It's a please, will you do X? Well, then Congress does the X part, and Congress can make the rules that they want to for this convention.
And I
think it's completely ludicrous to think that Vermont would have the same number of representatives voting, the same voting power as California. It's just not going to happen.
Well, that's what, you know, back at the on the Articles of Confederation, every state was supposed to approve. And of course, they ended up changing it to 9 states. But you make a good point. You make a good point where you mention that that the Vermont has a population of about 550,000 people.
Right.
And to
right.
think that their delegates will have as much say in a, hopefully it never happens, but if we do have one. The state of California with what? It's got 50 members of the House.
Yeah, 50 times 30,000. Right. That's right. About 37 million. Right. They're not going to let Vermont, you know, what they elect whomever they want to be governor, to be equal to California. It's simply
that's
not
right.
going to happen.
That's right.
And, you know, so this is what, and the second thing that I've never found to be satisfactorily answered is, if you don't trust the current people you have there now, why would you trust them to carry out a bunch of different words? The question, the structure is not the bad thing. It's the people running the ship who are putting us aground.
Since you have a great track record as a pro-lifer, I think it's important to address the Article 5 and the pro-life issue. I know back after Roe versus Wade, that horrible Supreme Court decision, which really wasn't a law, it was a decision that unfortunately was upheld by the Attorney General that made abortion legal in all the states. There was some pro-lifers, I think well-intentioned, that thought that, well, what we need to have an amendment to the Constitution to outlaw abortion. And over the course of so many years, about 20 states had applications for the sole purpose of a, an amendment to reverse Roe versus Wade. And I think that the groups like Convention of States, which is a relatively new group founded, I think, 2012, they appeal to conservatives and to pro-life Christians, et cetera. And they've used that as, so look at these people. They support abortion. I actually had one person say I had the blood of innocent babies on my hands. So how do you address that as a pioneer in the pro-life movement that was instrumental in the Hyde Amendment? How would you address that?
Well, there's absolutely no ground rule. You're betting everything on a process that is undifferentiated, undefined, and untested for about 230 years. I mean, speaking of gambling, I mean, that makes going to, you know, Las Vegas, you know, look like an absolute guaranteed income.
You're better off hitting the lottery than you are trying to expect. I think what happened was a lot of pro-life people realized that this wasn't the right way to go. And then I think by the mid-80s, it lost its momentum. And because I've been involved in the pro-life movement probably since 1988 or 87.
Right.
I was a good friend of Dr. Mildred Jefferson, pioneering the pro-life movement. And I don't recall anybody in the circles I was traveling in even thinking about an Article 5 convention, you know.
Well, what was interesting, the group you mentioned was from 2012, they would put out calls to a whole bunch of different interest groups. To the Right to Lifers, they say, look, you can get a constitutional amendment for abortion.
Right.
To the balanced budget people, they say, we can rein in federal spending. To the tax people, they say, we can curb tax. Any interest you have, it's almost like St. Paul, I'm all things to all people.
All things to all. I look at it more like a snake oil salesman. You know, whatever ails you, you know, you have gash, you're going bald, you have dandruff. You have, you know, upset stomach. This is a cure for all, a cure-all elixir.
If you don't have a sickness, we'll cure it anyway. So this is, you know, so in the House of Delegates, I was either credited or blamed, take your choice, with defeating the Article 5 call. And that was from Mark Levin on his radio program one time. And in the Senate was Senator Dick Black. So we were the ones who argued the most on this point. And it was just, you know, we still didn't pass. And there's still so many unanswered questions that I just can't see intelligently going forward. I mean, look, when you had the original convention, you had a unanimity of moral thought, moral behavior, and moral assumption. The Constitution was put to, I'm sorry, the Declaration says we are appealing to the laws of nature and nature's God.
Nature's God.
Nowadays, most people think that's a Catholic, you know, thing. But there was only one Catholic who was signing the Declaration, which was Charles Carroll of Maryland. So
that's right.
Again, when you had all these Protestants, Evangelicals, Episcopals, Congregationalists, whatever, natural law was what they were thinking. You don't have that now. Look, you have people who are running for national office who support the idea if somebody wants, if a guy thinks he's a woman, that's fine, and you better recognize
that's
it or
right.
punish you. I mean,
you can't
even get an agreement on who's a man and who's a woman. Are you telling me you're going to have a convention and arrive at some type of agreement? The ideological composition of a convention that would be called now would be the equivalent of the bar scene at Star Wars.
That's an incredible analogy.
Well,
yeah, I would
speculate
you'd probably have you'd have half of them would be hard leftist Democrats.
Right.
The other, I'd say, about 60-70% would be what we call neoconservative Republicans that really don't love the idea of limited government. And you might have those that share the view of the founders. I'd say about 2-3%. I might be a little optimistic on that. So it would be very difficult if I look at the Constitution, it's already how do you rein in big government? You're never allowed to have big government under the Constitution.
Well, how would you select the people to go to this convention?
Right.
You know, and again, right. would they run for office to get elected to it? If so, the people with the biggest name ID are the ones that are going to get chosen. So
yes, professional wrestlers and baseball players, former baseball players.
Well, really?
Players.
And then would you put spending limits on money to raise to get your message out to the public? There's so many unanswered questions, I can't even begin to stage them all in my mind. But it's not a Hail Mary pass. It's a pass to oblivion is what it is.
And I have to say that Virginia was a very key state because that is the home base of Mark Levin and also Mike Farris, who used to be
correct.
In the Adventure States. And I think when that was defeated a few years ago, and then again, I think it was this year or last year, that it was quite a setback because they figure Virginia is their home, home territory.
Right.
And you and your colleagues there have to be commended for defeating it. Now, well, I got a chance to meet you back in March down in,
yes.
I say down because I'm from Boston and down in Virginia.
Right.
And you had a book you had just authored called Reclaiming the Republic. And I guess if you go to our YouTube channel, Camp Constitution, I have you speaking about, I think, like a 5 or 6 minute presentation.
Right.
So
right.
tell us a little. So if we can't have an Article 5 convention to reclaim the public, as Convention of States claims, how do we reclaim the republic?
Well, remember what Christ said. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God.
What is God?
Now,
that's right.
That presumes something. It presumes you know who Caesar is. It presumes you know how Caesar operates, and it presumes that you know his rules that he's supposed to operate under and that you may have to operate against him. But if you don't know all that, you can't follow the mission that Christ gave to you to be the salt of the earth and the leaven of society because you're completely in the dark about how things are supposed to run. So I would suggest it's your Christian duty to understand the levers of power of civil government. The book I wrote will show somebody how to negotiate school boards, city councils, county councils, state legislatures, and Congress. I know every trick that there is because uh-huh. I worked in Congress for 6 years. Bob Dornan had me sit down in the library of the Cannon Building for about, I think, 6 or more weeks reading precedents from about 1800 to about 1965. I read them. Combined them, gave them to Bob Dornan, and he would throw these procedural grenades at Tip O'Neill, and we would tie the place up in knots because
wow.
I knew the rules and I gave it to Bob Dornan. If the citizens know the process, they can determine the outcome. And given what we are facing right now with the efforts of the LGBT, especially with this transgender stuff, to put us in a box, much like Stalin did to the Christians in the Soviet Union, or Chairman Mao did in China, or Hitler did to the evangelicals and the Catholics in Germany, you know, when he wasn't killing Jews, and then to Plutarco Calles in Mexico. If you were a lawyer, you could not go to church. You could not belong to a Christian church. You couldn't be a teacher. You couldn't have a government job. So you were completely cast out of the public square. You had to be basically a day laborer. That's how you could use your talents. You would have no influence in the public square. The other side, right now, there's a case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court about this Colorado baker. Now, he has no
yes.
animus against anybody. He just didn't want to. Look, he said these people who want to have the homosexual marriage, fine. Here's cupcakes. Here's cakes already in the front of my store here. You can buy them. They want him, however, to become part of their celebration of this same-sex marriage, which is like a square circle to me. He doesn't want to do that. That shouldn't even be a question. Well, they're impugning his motives. They're basically saying he's hating. Well, who else thought that only one man could marry one woman? Moses, Mother Teresa, Jesus, and Barack Obama before 2012.
That's right. In fact, even Hillary Clinton is on record as
correct.
Not in favor of...
Now,
yeah,
but, right. Mm-hmm. Now, are all those people or in those circumstances for Hillary and Obama, were they motivated by hate? I doubt it. I mean, first of all, you can't know if someone's... You can know by their actions if they're motivated by hate. But just to differ
right.
with somebody doesn't mean that you hate them. So, but this is... Listen, this has been a brilliant tactic on the part of the LGBT. They identify what they wanted with the civil rights movement, but it goes far beyond that. Let me give you a specific example. In legislatures across the United States right now, in the states, there are efforts to change what the equivalent of the Civil Rights or the Human Rights Act. Right now it says, in other words, you can't refuse to sell a house to somebody because they're black or because they're Catholic or, you know, or their nationality, whatever. The LGBT people want to add sexual orientation and gender identity. Well, first of all, it's not apparent to anybody that, you know, what your gender identity is. You don't have a mark on your forehead, 666 or whatever. It's just not there.
Right.
Secondly, there's no definition of gender identity. Thirdly, this is what this means. And I looked at the hearing down here in Richmond, and the author of it was a homosexual state senator. He was berating the representative of the, you know, two Catholic dioceses here. He says, oh, so you want to discriminate? And they use this word. Well, number one, everybody discriminates. We don't let 13-year-olds drive, but we let 18-year-olds drive. If you pass a test, you don't pass a test, you're going to get a ticket. Discrimination is merely line drawing. It's not invidious in and of itself. But this is the problem when you do this with housing. If you have a rule that says gender identity for housing or sexual orientation, what that means is that a bank in Massachusetts may not process a loan for a parsonage if that denomination doesn't marry two guys or two women to each other.
Mm.
Or if you have a separate, you know, understanding of, you know, who can use the locker room, excuse me, for the athletic team. Or if you're a Christian college, you can't assign a real married couple to dormitories without assigning the same-sex married couple to a dormitory, or two transgenders who say that they're deeply in love. That's what this means. This is very subtle, but it's part of all these statutes. A bunch of these laws are on the books. They're just not being fully implemented. But when the homosexuals get enough states to do this, they'll start to pull this in. And what they will do, they will push the Christians out of the economic sphere, squeeze them slowly. Their tax exemption is going to go next. We don't give a Ku Klux Klan fraternity hall a tax-exempt status, do we? No, because they're racially discriminatory. It doesn't say you can't use certain money for racial discrimination. It just says, if you have this policy, you cannot be exempt from taxes like a church is, or a fraternal organization, or a nonprofit group. But that's what's going to happen. The tax exempt status will be stripped from churches, and these other things
will
also happen.
What happened in Massachusetts? It was a Catholic adoption agency that would not put children in homosexual, you know, family, two men or two women,
right.
And because of our crazy laws, they went out of business. They just stopped doing it. And you would think you should be encouraging these types of activities. This was a private entity, you know, church entity that wasn't that was actually helping the state, you know, deal with the problem.
Correct.
And because they certainly didn't believe it was right to put a child in a homosexual couple, they wouldn't do it.
Couple,
they were
right.
they went and they could have simply obeyed the law, but they said, "How can they do it? This is against their principle."
You see, they want you to choose between Christ or Caesar. That is not an attitude of people who are tolerant of you. So that's why I wrote Reclaiming the Republic. This is a ground up book, starting with natural law, because the founders started with natural law, talking about religious liberty, the real reason for it, and the real understanding of it, the steps in legislation. For example, if some legislator says, hey, the bill that you liked was killed in committee, we can't do anything about it, you say, oh, yes, you can do something about it. You can discharge the committee. This is at the state level or at the level of Congress. And in other words, I show people the mechanics of how the system works or doesn't work. So if one roadblock is put up, I know a way around it, because I've dealt with them for years. So if you get this book, if the people listening to this program get the book, they are going to be so much more knowledgeable and dangerous, in fact, to leftists.
That's right.
Well, they are. Because, you know, knowledge is power. And what does it say in the book of Hosea? My people are destroyed for lack of
knowledge. Yeah.
Lack of knowledge. So this is the supplement in the civil order. And look, God the Father has used people who had knowledge of the government structures. He used two in the Old Testament expressly. Well, Moses was raised in the courts of Pharaoh. Joseph,
right.
The coat of many colors. He was the vice regent of the whole, you know,
Egypt
government and country of Egypt. So the knowledge of the powers of the civil order was used in individuals who honored the Lord to defend and protect his people. There's no reason why it can't be done today. And again, Reclaiming the Republic is the name of the book. You can get it on Amazon. If you don't like Jeff Bezos, there's a type in Alibris in the little URL search bar, and you'll come up with an aggregation of book sites, and you can also buy it there.
Now, do you make it available do you have a website where you can make it?
No, I don't. You can go to Tan Press or like I say, Amazon is the easiest. Alibris is the second. If you don't want to, you know, like make Bezos a billionaire again.
He already is, right?
right. He already is. So, but again, this is easy reading. This would be great for homeschoolers. I mean, absolutely great.
Well, we got about 4 minutes left, so. We're the fastest 30 minutes in radio.
You must condense time here. This is great. Let me mention some things. You know, to talk about religion not having any influence, or really shouldn't be having any influence, is simply ludicrous. When the founders said the standard to which they repaired to justify the revolution, which would have been a rebellion if they didn't succeed, but it succeeded, so it was a revolution, was the laws of nature and nature's God. They placed their hands in the future of the nation in the hands of divine providence. They said this a number of times. When you had the Northwest Ordinance, this was passed both on the Articles of Confederation when the colonists were looking to, you know, to bring more states into the Union. It was six states that was formed out of that. I think Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin. That's called the Northwest Ordinance. In the Northwest Ordinance, passed under the Articles and also repassed in the first Congress, was an expression in the Northwest Ordinance saying that, you know, religion shall be forever encouraged with respect to education, because the founders knew that the basis of morality was somewhere in religion. Now, that the second passage of the Northwest Ordinance occurred in the first Congress on the same day that the members took up the Bill of Rights, which included what became the First Amendment for freedom of religion. So if you're telling me there's no connection, you can't have any recognition of religion, the people that proposed the First Amendment did it on the same day that they were considering it.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And here, Thomas Jefferson has always cited it. Well, great separation of church and state. No, he only wanted to separate the federal government from the operation of certain, some religious things, but not all. Why do I say that? Under Jefferson, the United States made a treaty with the Kaskaskia Indians from, I think, Illinois, who were converted years before by French Catholic priest. Mm-hmm. The treaty provided as follows: $100 a year to pay for the maintenance of a priest for the Kaskaskia Indians, and I think it was for 5 years, and $500 to build a Catholic church. So what do you mean separation of church and state? This was a treaty, and Jefferson agreed to it. So all these claims that religion is a big no, the people making that claim are the no-no. And the way around it, Congress can limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court.
That's right.
I show how to do it, and in Federalist number 80, Federalist Paper number 80, that's the part of the essays that were used by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, who was the first Chief Justice. The end of the 80th essay, the last paragraph, Hamilton talks about basically if the Supreme Court or any federal court goes out of line, you can bring them back in by curbing their jurisdiction. And I have a memo that I serialize in the book from John Roberts, who's now the Chief Justice of the United States, but he was an Assistant Attorney General under Ronald Reagan. And he says, oh, yeah, you can do this. He pointed out that for certain cases, you could not even get a challenge from a state Supreme Court to a federal court for 125 years. It wasn't until 1913 that you couldn't get certain cases heard on even federal questions in the U.S. Supreme Court. So you could have California deciding one way, the state of Missouri a second, Massachusetts a third way, Maryland a fourth, and the Supreme Court a fifth, it was fine. It didn't matter. There was no way to reconcile them because there was no ability to pull the case out of the state's court system into the federal courts because the total question of appellate jurisdiction is up to Congress exclusively.
That's right. And so where can folks, we got a few seconds left, where can folks get a copy of your book again, How to Reclaim the Republic?
Go on Amazon tonight and type in Reclaiming the Republic or type in, just in the search bar for Google, just type in Alibris, and that'll take you to the collection of stores that's, under the name of Alibris, and type in my title, Reclaiming the Republic. There's a Kindle version and there's a hardback version.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bob, for being on, and thank you for listening. You're listening to Camp Constitution Radio on WBCQ, The Planet. Until next week, may God bless you.
Keep going with the Constitution. Thank you. Bye.